Good morning, everybody. You don't want to hear me that loud, do you? All right. This week and two more weeks, and then you have another opportunity to can me. This week we're going to be in Hosea. We talked a little bit about Amos a couple weeks ago and how that tied in similarly to Hosea as far as time period, as far as one's preaching to one side and one's preaching to another side and in a divided kingdom preaching, prophesying, part of the minor prophets. So this is one that is highly, I mean, there's movies. Has anybody seen the, is it called Hosea? The movie?
Redeeming Love.
Redeeming Love. Has anybody watched Redeeming Love? It's actually, I sound like a chick right now, huh? It's a chick flick very much, so I might throw myself under the bus. But it is pretty... it's not historical time period, it's... olden days, horse and wagon time period, but follows the same storyline of what Hosea was called to do. And I think we all know what Hosea was called to do, is marry, in biblical words, a woman of whoredom. And God kind of uses that to say, this is what Israel does to me. And so we're going to talk about several of these things. I really want to get... it's 14 chapters. No way I'm going to get through all of them, so I'm going to give you little glimpses. We're going to start in chapter 1 because that's when Hosea gets his calling. We're going to bounce around a little bit and probably end up in chapter 11 is the goal. Because I think we have to keep in mind what this tells us about God. And so in this story of Hosea, it might seem... gruesome, or it might seem off-putting a little bit that God calls one of his prophets into this relationship. And so oftentimes we get kind of a bitter taste in our mouth of, hey, why would God even call somebody into having to put up with this? But then on the flip side, you see, hey, God's using this as an example of what we do to Israel and something that relates way more to us. Because a lot of us are married in here, or will be married, or have had relationships, or whatever the case may be. And so this is something that hits home incredibly. And there's a couple things that I feel convicted that this should call us into. The biggest one of which is humility, and we'll talk about that here a little bit later. But then it also genuinely paints just the most beautiful picture of God. It's not always how we take it. Because there's strong language in here, and I think nowadays we don't like something that's direct. We like to sugarcoat things. We don't like the... honest answer, the honest response that God gives, because it seems like he's angry or frustrated. Guess what? He talks about it. He's frustrated. He's frustrated with this repetitious pattern of Israel turning their backs and worshiping these idols and going away from God. And then who's the guy that always brings them out? Not them. God. It's a nonstop, pretty much one-way relationship. And so and we don't like reading that oftentimes, because who in here likes conflict? I kind of do, my wife would say. My dad would probably say. But that's not something that's probably normal. I'm all messed up, I'll admit it. But not a lot of people like conflict. Not a lot of people like to get into situations that might be uncomfortable. And out of that stems typically deceit or sugarcoating or doling down what's going on. And we see that a little bit, but we don't see that coming from God. In chapter 11, we're going to get into it. And a lot of times we can focus on the bad that he's talking about, because he's laying out what these people are doing over and over. And then afterwards is sometimes the part we skim over is the love part, because when we hear something bad, how easy is it to hear something good after and be like, oh, okay. It's not always easy. A lot of times we like to start to stew on the bad. We did, I won't get into it immensely, but we did employee reviews this past 2 weeks ago. Bull. I've come to realize most people really just wanted to hear the good. And employee review is not what I thought it was supposed to be, which was constructive criticism, along with the good and the praises for the good. But hey, if you want to make it to the next level, this is what you do. And oddly enough, nobody likes to hear that, which is not something that I anticipated, but something I learned in employee review number one. And Kevin's laughing over here because he was got to be a part of that, and it was different. Yeah. After that, I just started sugarcoating everything. Just kidding. But it's the human condition, and one thing this book does really well is it depicts the human condition really well as God's side of it, and the loving and the merciful God. He even goes as far as to, in chapter 11, describe himself. And it's one of the few instances in the Bible where God is just really blunt about his character, that he just lays it all out there. And so we'll get into that. I'm excited about that. This is an incredible book. I hope, I know that I say this a lot, but I hope if y'all have time, you can read through these 14 chapters, because it's a lot in there that we won't be able to go through. Hopefully we can hit the highlights and the low lights today, and then it can fill in pretty well if you go back through and read it. So we're going to start in Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam and the sons of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. And I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel, and on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. She conceived again and bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all, but I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son, and the Lord said, call his name Not My People, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the number of children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. And they shall go up from the land for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Chapter 2, say to your brothers, you are my people, and to your sisters, you have received mercy. Plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband, that she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and make her like a parched land, and kill her with thirst. Upon her children I will have no mercy, because they are children of whoredom. For their mother has played the whore, she who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore I will hedge up her way with thorns. I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. She shall, do you start to hear this verbiage? She will seek, she will not find. She will pursue, but she will not overtake. This is opposite of what we're learning in the Sermon on the Mount. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for bale. Therefore I will take back my grain in its time, and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, which were there to cover her nakedness. I want us to really focus on that stretch of verses, because it goes through this poem. And a lot of Hosea is written in poetry, and we see these poems of just Hosea's frustration, and it's this depiction of what Israel does to God, but it's also a depiction of what he's going through right now. And what happens with his wife is she runs away and runs to greet her old lovers. And Hosea is in this place where he's not sure what to do. And she said, hey, I'm just going to go back to my first husband because it was better for me there. Why? Because she's seeking, she's not finding, nothing is panning out for her. So what's better? Hey, I'm just going to return. We see this of the people of Israel. We probably see it in our own lives. How many of us does it take getting really, 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 really bad before you turn your chin to God? And in the poem, we see that, and she gets stripped naked, and all this stuff happens, and she's laying bare, and nothing that she's looking for is filling that hole. And so she says, hey, I'm going to return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know. What did she not know? That it was I who gave the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Whoa. God's saying, hey, I gave you everything. All this stuff that you have, that you take, and what do you do with it? Not anything for me. What do you do with it? You take it to an idol. She did not realize it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold. See, we see these stories. We saw Solomon in his day, and he's garnering this great wealth. And what did we talk about then is, hey, it gets pretty easy to start doing this. He's got a wealthy kingdom. He's got all these servants. The halls are lined with gold. He spent 7 years on the Lord's house. He spends 14 years on his own mansion that he's probably got concubines and slaves and rich fruits. And all this stuff seems to be going right. And even Solomon, with all his wisdom, what does he do? He turns his back on everything that God had instructed. Everything to immense detail, right? It says, do not collect great wealth. Do not import horses from Egypt. Do not. And it goes down this whole list of stuff that he's not supposed to do. And then right afterwards, we see the whole list of stuff that we didn't think you were supposed to do, and he's now doing it. And we're going, hey, what is going on? And in his mind, he's probably shifted to everybody's praising him for his wisdom, and he starts to get pretty easy to pat himself on the back, and God's up there going, who gave you all this? From the very beginning, he asked God for what? Wisdom. And it was granted to him in abundance, wiser than any man before and wiser than any man after. He gained this wisdom in abundance. And then he uses it to do the exact opposite of what God told him a kingdom should be run. That's pretty tough. And in Hosea, we have a similar depiction of forgetting where all of this is coming from. Because things start to go good, we start to relax, we start to think, hey, how many of this is this shamefully one to admit, but how many, you don't even have to raise your hand, I'll raise my hand. How many of y'all have had things going immensely well and you're like, man, I did good? I've been there. In the industry, not so much as today in the auto world, but when you're a salesperson at a new car store, and you're trying to make X amount of cold calls every day, and you just have a banger of a month, and you work incredibly hard, it's easy to sit back at the end of the month and go, all right, I worked incredibly hard. I did this, I did that, I. And it's pretty easy to forget where all of that came from. I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And I think we can start to hopefully bring in that same verbiage as used in a parable that Jesus talked about. Hopefully it's ringing bells. Prodigal son. Youngest son goes and blows his whole inheritance. And then what does he say? I think I'm going to go back to my dad's house, because even his servants are treated better than this. And then what happens when he returns? See, all this should start to mesh together in our brains. What happens when the prodigal son returns? To the frustration and dismay of the oldest son. Dad opens up his arms, kills the fattened calves, has a party. He's excited that his son that went astray came back in that same depiction, but it hits home more in Hosea, doesn't it? Because that's not as gruesome of a story. That's about a young, dumb man who goes and blows his inheritance. And we're all probably like, yeah, if I got a huge lump sum of money when I was immature and young, I would probably blow it too. You see, a lot of people do it in the lottery. Well, now let's hit home extremely close with the story about Hosea. And that is more extreme to me than the prodigal son. And so, but I think it's important to put them together there. But Hosea is called to marry a prostitute, a woman of whoredom. And she runs around on him. And what is God telling him to do? Take her back. How many times? As many times as she runs away. Cool. That strikes some chords with me. And we're going to go to chapter 11 here because I know I'm running out of time. But what I do want to say this briefly. I was hoping I'd get into it a little bit more. There's a guy at work that I talk to frequently that his words resonate with me, especially in a story like this. And it makes me think. When somebody acts, and I don't know if I've said this before, but when somebody does something to him that should be offensive, that should be bothersome, that by any stretch of the human imagination, we would probably take poorly. You know what his reaction is? And it didn't used to be this way. Dad's known him since he was 18 years old. And he used to be a little bit of a hothead kid, always wanting to scrap. And his reaction now is that his old reaction was human tendency, human nature, which is, hey, I'm going to stick up for myself. Somebody does something mean to me, I'm bowing up. We're going after it, at the very least verbally. His reaction now is, man, how much more have I done to God? If somebody humiliates him, if somebody speaks illy of him, if something happens to him, that human nature would be to react incredibly poorly. Vengeance, revenge, whatever would be sparked up naturally. Says, man, how much more have I done to God?
The grace of God, there am I.
There they are also. Right? Who are we? And this is a very genuine statement. And it's changed a lot of my perspective, not saying that I'm great with it all the time, because that's something I have to overcome in my own pride. But genuinely, who are we? Who are we to get our vengeance, our revenge? Who are we to get uprooted to the point of just anger and lashing out? Who are we to do all these things when how much more have you done to God? How many times have you turned your back on God? And what are we, and this is going back to the Sermon on the Mount, is God says, hey, you're going to be judged on your own principles to an extent. You judge these people harsher than you're willing to judge yourself. You're judging these people harshly and then turning around and going, hey, God, will you forgive me for doing that exact same thing to you? How backwards is that? The level of humility that we should walk with, and again, I guess I went longer than I thought I was going to on this part. People oftentimes take that as weakness, and I'm not sitting here saying that you should be a doormat. I think if you look at Christ's example, the very last thing he is a doormat. People are fired up, but they're not walking on him. He's standing on the firm foundation of God. He's speaking what people don't have arguments for. He's standing on truth. And what is that? That's not doormat. He's standing up on truth. People like to think, though, that humility or too much humility takes away from your manhood, takes away from this, takes away from that. And, oh, you can't do that if you just get walked on all the time. And I'm here to tell you, 100% honestly, if you read the story of Christ and all the examples, the last thing that guy was a doormat. Because what did it take to shut him up? Still not, right? Go ahead.
So, I take the same thing from that, but I also, especially recently, had something at work similar, right? Took offense to something, a behavior that was directed towards me, and got quite upset. But do you have enough internal monologue to assess your part in that relationship? Because every relationship, you're 50% of it. So if you have a cosmic one,
to be self-aware.
I'm walking around with like a piss-poor look on my face and I have a bad attitude and somebody responds negatively. Maybe it's because of that, right? Like maybe when I walked in and gave my wife a look and she didn't respond as I would hope, right? Maybe that's my problem, not hers, right? And so I think it's a little bit more like, of course, the God aspect of being human and like retrospect, but like, where are you? Where are you in the right state of mind, the right state of existence? Are you in your priorities set correctly?
And again, I think that takes us right. And I hope we're starting to see. I love that Kevin's been doing the Sermon on the Mount, but that's take the speck out of your eye, take the plank out of your eye before you go after the speck in somebody else's, right? And so that's, we're starting to build this beautiful picture of the humility. But again, that's not a doormat. That's standing up for truth. Anytime you're saying something in the terms of standing up for, does that mean you're getting walked on? No. But you're doing it as Christ did it. And that's not with these brash outbursts and this violence or whatever, the fight or flight, or if it's deceitfulness or talking behind somebody's back, trying to get the leg up or whatever the case that would be for you. For me, I like to be up front in somebody's face. For my wife, not so much, but hey, some things might happen behind the scenes, right? And so we each have that response to things that humiliate us or that degrade us or whatever the case may be. And I do think it's important to keep in mind, what do I do constantly to God? And I think this hits home so immensely for us, because we're taking to this probably in most of our existences, Hosea's the ultimate betrayal. What would hurt us on earth more than anything? Probably a spouse openly running around on you, saying openly, not even in the shadow. She's very blatantly running around. And the response to that is, hey, go get her. Go get her. And we do that to God constantly. Constantly. Go ahead.
But you also have to think of this act, like, it's a major travesty in today's current events, right, for somebody to do that. Back then, that wasn't just a travesty. Like, I mean, women were stoned to death for that behavior, right? And for the man to just continue to be allowing of that behavior and accepting of that behavior, like, I think really is, like, has to impact you as you're thinking about him.
Amazing point. Because also in this time, on God's perspective, this is the time of law. So what should happen to all of us, right? And that's exactly the time, that time women are getting stoned in this time period for the exact same thing. And what God has set forth in the law means death for us all. Yeah, and so we're starting to get this picture. And did he already buzz me? I kind of tune him out. Once buzz. We're starting to build this picture of the severity of it, and I think we can think about the severity of it in our own life. And I hope the reaction to that is humility. Let me flip over to chapter 11 real fast. Because again, and this, what Kevin just said is going to roll seamlessly into chapter 11, because whose grace is it to give? It's God's. And there's a fine line. I'm going to say this. We do not have opportunity of salvation for anything we did. Pretty bluntly. It's nothing that you could do nor I could do to grant us the opportunity of salvation. All of it started with grace and mercy being extended by God. It's our job to step into that and bring people into that. to plant the seed and let God water it. Hosea chapter 11. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offering to the idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led with the cords again. They did not know that I healed them. I led with cords of kindness, with the bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. And I bent down to them and fed them. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword shall rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them. Because of their own counsels, my people are bent on turning away from me. And though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? I want you to hear the change in attitude. We just heard this frustration in what God is saying right here. And then the next verse is, how can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man. Whew. Powerful statement. All these things that I just spoke are reactions of human nature. But I am God and not man. They shall go after the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children shall come trembling from the west, and they shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the hand of Assyria, and I will return them to their homes, declares the Lord. Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit, but Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. They multiply falsehood and violence. They make covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. The Lord has indictment against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. And then he's about to buzz me, so we're going to get into this. But the big thing I want us to get out of that is, to whose credit is that mercy extended? Because he's not painting this in a very good light, right? This is a dark painting of the state of Israel right now. But what does he say? My compassion grows warm inside me, and I will bring them out of this. He's going to deliver them into it, but he will bring them out of it. Anything to do with the people of Israel? No. To do with God's love and compassion. And we should be incredibly thankful and joyous that that's the God we serve, because when we turn away, or when we go through our human tendencies and we fall back into the stuff that we're called out of, who's waiting on the other side? That's pretty exciting. And again, we could go into Romans, and I think the verse in Romans was there when it talks about, shall we just go on sinning? By no means. And so we're starting to get a big rounded picture of this whole relationship, and we could talk about it for probably a year. Sadly, we're already out of Hosea. We're on to the next thing, but go read it, because unless you slow down, Hosea can be a confusing book, because it's written in poetry, and it's almost like you see a bipolar nature going on. And you just see this inner struggle that God's having with this is what I should do. Just as Jason said, this is what I should do. I should take her outside the city and I should stone her. But my heart grows warm with compassion, and these are the people that I've loved since I brought them out of Egypt, since the very beginning. They're my chosen people. And my heart grows warm with compassion, and so therefore, what am I going to do? Deliver them. It's a powerful story. It's an attestment, and I hope y'all read it again and again and again. God actually gives us a glimpse into his character in that poem, and it's amazing. Because very few times do we get these. I mean, he doesn't play hide the peanut. I say that a lot. He's not playing hide the peanut, but very often it's not so direct. He plays a very good boss, God does, where he's not necessarily just hammering it straight on every time, but trying to pull us into this curiosity and this mystery. Is there any other comments, questions? I appreciate all the dialogue today. It's good to have. Thank y'all for being here. Thank you, sir. Can't complain.